See, I have set before you today life and prosperity, death and adversity. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I am commanding you today, by loving the Lord your God, walking in his ways, and observing his commandments, decrees, and ordinances, then you shall live and become numerous. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you do not hear, but are led astray to bow down to other gods and serve them, I declare to you today that you shall perish. You shall not live long in the land that you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Choose life, that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying him, and holding fast to him. For that means life to you and length of days, so that you may live in the land that the Lord swore to give to your ancestors, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. This is the word of the Lord. Next week, Tuesday in fact, I am looking forward to meeting with one of our women's circles. The morning circle is doing a Bible study on the letter to the Hebrews, a document that was probably circulated as a sermon in the early church. So they have invited me to come and spend some time talking about sermons. How do you put a sermon together? Where do the ideas come from? Where do sermons come from? It's a wonderful invitation because a lot of sermons are constructed in isolation. Maybe you've wondered, where do sermons come from? The quick answer is this: a blue wingback chair in my living room. That's the sermon writing chair. Most Saturday mornings, I turn on the coffee at 7 o'clock, and by 7:15, I'm at it. That's where I am. A lot of thinking happens in that chair. A lot of procrastinating happens in that chair. And sooner or later, I start tapping out the words on a rapidly aging laptop computer. The sermons come from the blue chair. Of course, there's more to the answer. Before the words ever get written down, there are books to read and thoughts to organize and prayers to offer and rhetoric to arrange. That blue chair is located very close to my imaginary compost heap, where I dig up the words that have been fermenting for a while. A lot of the sermons begin to percolate during a week in January where I spend studying the Bible with a lot of my friends, and in a deeper sense, that's where sermons come from. But here's the thing I wonder. How do sermons end? It's a good question. I know the answer for a lot of you. The sermon should end as quickly as possible. I happen to agree. There's no need for extra blathering. Say what you need to say and sit down. In fact, you've heard the old dictum about making speeches. Tell them what you're going to tell them, and tell them what you just told them. In my mind, that speech is three times as long as it needs to be. Why not tell them? But how should the sermon end? My friend Jim Thyron and I visited Yale Divinity School back in October. Saw a picture of Phil on the wall, the refectory. The setting was the Lyman Beecher lectures in preaching. The most important lectures in preaching in the world. The lecture was Dr. Tom Troger, a longtime friend. He writes sermons and books and poetry and lyrics for hymns in our hymnal. The title of the lecture series was The End of Preaching. Not just the question, will this sermon ever end, but what's the end of it all? What follows the sermon? And Tom's answer, the end of preaching, is prayer. What should follow the sermon is an expression of honest prayer, a life of prayer, a relationship with God of devotion and commitment. That's how the sermon ends, he says. I like that. As for me, I have often followed the advice of Fred B. Craddock, a short little man who was a giant of a preacher. Fred used to say, always end your sermon about 2 minutes early. Some of you have noticed I like to do that. End the sermon before you're done, and then the congregation has to end it for you. The burden is then shared on their shoulders too. They have to complete it in the lives that they live. They have to finish it in the daily work that they take forward. Which is to say, the end of the sermon is in what we do with what we have just heard. Now, what started me on that rabbit trail is not the invitation from the Presbyterian women. It's the passage we heard from Deuteronomy. You see, the book of Deuteronomy is a sermon. A very long 30-chapter sermon. The passage from the end of chapter 30 is the end of it. And before we talk about the ending, let me give you the whole sermon in a nutshell. Ready? Got something to write this down? Okay. Here's the sermon of Deuteronomy. If you follow the ways of God, it will go good for you. Did you get that? If you follow the ways of God, it's good for you. Now, saints of God, some of you will notice Moses takes 30 chapters to make his point. And no doubt, many of you are already accustomed to a preacher going on far too long to say much too little. If I may defend the preacher, sometimes the preacher needs to repeat things over and over again in order to get them to sink in. And sometimes the preacher has to spell things out in depth in order for the message to have any gravitational weight. So welcome to Deuteronomy. The theme of the long, long sermon, if you follow the ways of God, it is good for you. That comes up chapter after chapter after chapter, text after text. Do the commandments, walk in God's ways, choose the ways of abundant life, love the Lord your God by doing what God says, and it will be good for you. Now that's the end of the sermon, at least the end of Moses' sermon. I'm not quite done with you yet, because I want to reflect for a few minutes on the connection between living in God's ways and the experience of well-being. You see, Moses is operating on two assumptions here. The first is that we are able to follow the ways of God. We're able to do that. The second assumption is that we don't always follow the ways of God. There you have it, the human situation. We've been told what's right, we know in our bones what's right, but we don't always do what's right. Our greatest challenge is dealing with our own resistance to the ways of God that can make us well. So God says, do not lie. Tell the truth. Sounds good. But if you make up a story to explain to your friend why you didn't want to go to her birthday party, she could find out the truth and it would damage your relationship. you might not be friends anymore because you lied. God says, honor your father and your mother. It does not spell out that commandment, so we have to figure out that anew in every season of life. When we're young, it means honoring them by not sassing and talking back. When we're teenagers, it means we honor our parents even though we think they're stupid. When we reach midlife, we honor our parents because we've discovered they're not stupid, but our partners in wisdom. And when our parents advance in years and decline in strength, we honor our parents by ensuring they are always safe and cared for. Now, what I like about that commandment is what it goes on to say. Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long, that it will go well with you. Ever notice that? Taking care of your parents is not only good for them, it's good for us. The assumption here is that we can do these things, that we can choose to follow God. Daily life does not have to be random, it can be intentional. If God says don't lie, then don't lie. If God says don't take away somebody's life, then don't take away the life. And this is intended in the deepest and widest possible senses. As we heard from the gospel reading, Jesus will push the commandments beyond any superficial application. You have heard it said, don't murder. But I say to you, don't let your anger linger toward another person. And don't ever attack another child of God through your words. Why? Because living in deep resentment and murderous rage is not really living. As somebody once quipped, when you're angry, when you lick your chops at somebody else's misfortune, the skeleton at the feast is you. Every day is full of choices. Thousands of years ago, Moses knew that. And you know when Israel remembers him as giving this sermon, it's when they're on the mountain and he's on the verge of taking them into the promised land. After 40 years of camping in the wilderness, now it's time to receive the land God wants them to have. It's stretched out in front of them, all that milk and honey. And that's precisely when Moses says, watch out. Don't forget about God. Choose the life that is meant to be life, and never take that gift for granted. He says this on the mountain as they face the temptation of unlimited possibilities. You could either do this, or you could do that. Either life or death, either a blessing or a curse, either love God or forget about God. That's the choice, and it's the choice before us 100 times each day. That doesn't mean it's easy. Not at all. I remember going through a season when I was feeling worn out, and as I thumbed through a magazine one day, I got into the book review section, and I found a book being reviewed about taking care of yourself. So I bought the book. Chapter 1 said, you are a person who makes choices. If you want to live a balanced, healthy life, you have to choose that every day. When you're tired, choose to get some rest. When you're hungry, choose something to eat. If you're bored, choose to get up and get moving. If you're eating too much, choose to practice restraint. It's really quite simple. Which is why it's so difficult. So Moses stands on the mountain and says, I am setting before all of you a choice, a life or death choice. If you love God enough to follow his ways, you shall live. And if you don't, well, so what are you going to do? My friend Terry Chapman sent along a poem the other day. It's about a saying no to death in all of its forms and saying yes to life, locally, globally, however we live. The poet is Edwina Gately, a woman of faith who works in Chicago with homeless women and victims of domestic abuse. And the title is Called to Say Yes. We are called to say yes, that the kingdom might break through to renew and to transform our dark and groping world. We stutter and we stammer to the lone God who calls and pleads a new Jerusalem in the bloodied Sinai Straits. We are called to say yes, that honeysuckle may twine and twist its smelling leaves over the graves of nuclear arms. We're called to say yes, that children might play on the soil of Vietnam where the tanks belched blood and death. We're called to say yes, that black may sing with white and pledge peace and healing for the hatred of the past. We are called to say yes so that nations might gather and dance one great movement for the joy of humankind. We are called to say yes so that rich and poor embrace and become equal in their poverty through the silent tears that fall. We are called to say yes, that the whisper of our God might be heard through our sirens and the screams of our bombs. We are called to say yes to a God who still holds fast to the vision of the kingdom for a trembling world of pain. We are called to say yes to this God who reaches out and asks us to share his crazy dream of love. That's the sermon. When you depart the sanctuary, your job is to finish it.